was asked to do the opposite of what I did last night, which was really to say, how did I come to be such a difficult person? Isn't that it? I mean, how did I fall down this road, which is apparently a relatively unusual road that a public intellectual. I don't ever say that about myself, but I thought about it a little bit, and when I was 5 years old, my father was an army officer in the Prince of Patricias. And if you're in the Prince of Patricias, you have a very easy kind of idea of religion and mythology. There's a senior god, and that was a guy called Brigadier Hamilton Gault, who raised the regiment in 1914, Hammy Gault, and who lost a leg and clumped around with one leg on until the 60s when he died. Quite an astonishing figure. And then under him there was God, and then sort of under him there was the Colonel-in-Chief, Princess Patricia, and things. But there's no question that the senior person in the skies was Hammy Gault. And when my father was a major, and I was 5 years old, we were in Ottawa at that point, in the summer, Hammy Gault would invite young officers, in that old patrician way, to come and spend a weekend and with his family. And he had a lake south of Montreal, it now belongs to McGill. It's an old volcano with a lake in the middle of it and apple orchards around it. I don't know, I think it's Lake of Two Mountains, near Saint-Hilaire, I don't know if any of you have been there. Beautiful place, quite a big lake, actually. Anyway, so we were invited there, and of course my brother is 2.5 years older than me, and I were terrified out of our wits. I mean, meeting God is really quite frightening. And, we got there, and he had the most beautiful wife who was English, and was the first English woman to have a flying license and so on. Quite astonishing beauty out of the 1930s, and right to the end. And anyway, we got there, and there they were, and we were cowering, my brother and I, and he sort of relaxed things by pointing out that he had a little sailboat in the middle of the lake and would we like to go sailing, at which point my father said, yes, sir. My brother said yes, and I was 5 years old. And so at that point, God sat down and pulled off his trousers and revealed, of course, he had a metal leg. We knew this, but we'd never seen it, right, or seen one, and started to unstrap his leg. And then he got back to his feet and hopped down and threw himself in the water and started swimming out. And of course, my father immediately stripped down, his good major, and threw himself in the water. And my brother, who's quite an athletic guy, did the same and left me standing on the shore. Nobody thought that maybe he can't swim that far, and if he can, we better swim with him or anything. And I was left there, and I simply didn't have the courage to swim out to that boat. And it was the first great failure of my life. I mean, I didn't just fail. I failed in front of God, right? And my father and my brother. So it was really pretty appalling. And then they came back, and I didn't say anything. It took me years to realize that it was probably the determining event of my life. Because since then, usually if put to a challenge, I automatically go. Whatever it is. Sometimes it's totally the wrong thing to do. But that sort of sense that, you have to be out there, you have to go, you mustn't miss the chance to be, existential, I think is born that day out of failure. So I owe him a great deal, actually. I mean, you owe God a great deal. And in this case, it was a demonstration of failure at a very early age. And there's actually, if you look at my website, there's a photograph taken about 2 minutes before he announced that he was going to throw himself in the water with everyone looking very elegant, and me before humiliation. It's kind of I just thought it'd be fun to put up there. I just noticed an interview of Desmond Tutu in which he was asked various questions, and he said, "We say we have free will, but it's not entirely the case. It is, as Luther said, I stand here, I can do no other." And I think that is really, I think Luther made a mess of things terribly, but actually as a line, it's a fabulous line, I stand here, I can do no other. And I think that's something that scholars and intellectuals, that's what I was talking about last night, is that feeling that one must do. So let me I was thinking about there were various moments in my life, but I think there was one when I was finishing my PhD and I was beginning to work on The Birds of Prey, my first novel, and it was based around whether or not the head of the French army, General Eyre, had in fact been in a plane accident or whether he'd been in a plane intended accident and assassinated. And I was interviewing various people. And of course, everybody was still alive and it was relatively dangerous apparently because the people, if it was an assassination, I was perhaps talking to those people. And I was the only one doing it. And at a certain point, I found there was a document that if this document existed, it indicated it was probably an assassination. If it didn't exist, then it was just a rumor. And Paris is always filled with rumors, you know. Every president is a great lover. Everyone who dies is assassinated. I mean, that's the kind of Paris way of thinking of things. You always think of the best or the worst. You never think about reality because it's not much fun. You know? And anyway, I went to see a guy called Alexandre Sanguinetti, a Corsican with one leg, there's a theme here, who was a great resistance leader in Corsica, and then during the OAS uprising had been the guy in charge of torturing French officers who were in the breakaway group, right-wing breakaway group of officers who tried to overthrow and assassinate de Gaulle. His job was to structure the capturing of them one by one and then the torturing of them in Paris, to get them to name other officers who they'd go out and get and then torture them and get more names. And that's how they broke the rebellion in 61, 62. So, you know, he's a guy who knew a lot about people dying on purpose. And so I went, and he was at that time the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the National Assembly and a great honored figure. And, you know. So I went to see him and I said, you know, Monsieur Sanguinetti, I've heard that this document exists. I didn't say why. I was interested. Just, it sounds like such an interesting document. I'm working on my doctorate, and I'd love to see it. And if you know about this document, he said, "Oh, my dear boy, fine. You know, come back and see me in a week." And I came back a week later, and he brought me into his room, office, and locked the door, and then threatened me for a half an hour. But of course, you know, that kind of threat from a very sophisticated man was fascinating because he never actually said what would happen. He just made it clear it would happen, and. And I was sitting there, you know, sweating away, and which seemed to be my want in life. And then he let me out the door. And as I went down the corridor, I thought to myself, I'm obviously right. He was assassinated. This is fantastic. As opposed to, and I got that from those earlier days, that sort of idea that there are great ideas, but there's also that necessity of being on the line. And it was his threats that made me feel that I had to go forward. And I just realized then that the only way to go for it was always to make sure that you were covered, that if they did something to you, there would be more damage to them than to me, that you had documents in the right place and people who would speak out and stuff like that. And I say all of these things because when we went to Rideau Hall, and actually you asked me last night, did anybody, it's why I thought I'd just finish with this.
Frank's question, yeah.
Yeah, did anybody say to me, you better be careful what you say, you better keep your mouth shut or anything. And the interesting thing was that nobody said a word to me. There was never a word said. Now, that might be because they knew that I knew more about the Constitution than they did, that I'd actually written about the role of the Governor General, etc. And I made it pretty clear that I understood the institution. There was a paper on the three pillars of Canadian foreign policy, which became Canadian foreign policy for about a decade, and I wrote that, and it put the Governor General at a central role in that. And so I was already on paper explaining how this whole thing worked. And so in a sense, they knew that I was fairly safe in terms of understanding the Constitution, written and unwritten, because most of it's unwritten, right, this country. The Constitution is semi-irrelevant. You know, the head of state of Canada is not the Queen. The head of state of Canada is the Governor General. All the powers of the Queen were handed to the Governor General in 1947. Nobody ever says that, you know, but it's not really written down clearly, but it's just filled with stuff like that. Anyway, I knew that in order to get through those 6 years, I would have to be, there were two tests. The first test was, since it was the first time a spouse had been, you know, a well-known leading intellectual in the country, known for speaking his mind, that if I didn't act in a completely public ethical manner, I would not only have betrayed myself, I would have betrayed the calling of the scholars, the independent scholars, and so on. And therefore, there was an enormous obligation on me to do the job. If I didn't do the job, it was a cop-out. Like, you know, she could do it. She doesn't need a spouse, whereas you do actually need somebody with you. But if I did it and I gave, you know, mealy-mouthed speeches and didn't identify causes, then I would have betrayed profoundly what I'd said in all my books, and therefore nobody should read my books or listen to me ever again. But I think that if you go back through those 6 years, you'll see that I very, very carefully chose the issues and spoke very carefully but very clearly on the issues, always within the constitutional parameters. because I do believe in democracy, and therefore, if you're not the elected official, you speak within certain parameters. But it was a lot of it was really existential. I mean, some of it was actually saying very clearly in public. I'll tell you. When we first started, we spent an afternoon with a bunch of kids out of the poorest area in Toronto, and then Adrian had to go off somewhere. And I was there, and I said, you know, I'm from Toronto, but I've never seen the totality of, you know, the disaster, of the problems, and I'd really like to see it. And they said, well, we can take you around tonight. And the RCMP said, no, you can't do that, Your Excellency. This is not far too dangerous. You know, I mean, you enter into another world. I mean, people say, what are you doing with those police? Well, the answer is there isn't any country in the world where the top three or four people of the country are not surrounded by police. So if you say you don't want certain things, you have to do it in a certain way. Otherwise, you're creating problems for everybody else. So I said, no, I'm going. You know, so you just figure it out on your side. And then the police have to scramble. And so anyway, I went around with a couple of guys who were who knew it all, with Ann Golden, who was a leading figure in this area in Toronto, and spent the next 6-7 hours going to virtually every shelter, food bank, whatever, and also places where people, you know, places the equivalent of the downtown East Side. And I came back. I didn't say a word publicly. I just wanted to think about it, having looked at it. And they talked about it. And about 2 weeks later, a journalist came to me and said, you know, surely you're interfering in the political area by doing this. And I had this terrible moment when I thought, you know, how do I deal with this ethically? And I said, well, tell me, and intellectually, I said, tell me something. It's an interesting question. Which is the political party which is in favor of poverty and homelessness? And the journalist looked at me and he said, oh. I said, yeah. It seems to me that homelessness and poverty is a civilizational failure. It's not a political failure. If politicians fail to deal with it, that's their failure, but it's a complete civilizational failure. And having succeeded at this, I was then able for 6 years to talk about homelessness and poverty. I mean, thanks to Jim, the first thing I did in Vancouver was start going down to the downtown East Side for 6 years every single time. This morning I was down there, go down there and see people and talk to people. And what I was attempting to do was nothing very grand. What I was attempting to do was to say that people like that should go to places like that, because they're citizens, A, and therefore should be seen by people who are thought to be at the top, and B, if you go and what you're seeing is unacceptable, then it is that true existential thing. You, by your presence, are demonstrating that it's unacceptable. And it became, you got better and better at it. So I think the second time I went down there, somebody was saying, can't remember if it was you, was saying, well, you know, there are these slum landlords and they're, you know, they're doing these all things. And I said, well, is there one nearby? And they said, yes, this one just across the street. And I said, let's go. Now, if I told them in advance, they wouldn't have let me go. But I just started walking. And we just walked right in and upstairs into this appalling, you know, place. And there's nothing special about it. It doesn't mean I did anything special. What it meant was that somebody in that position, instead of going into a fancy ball, was going into exploitative slum landlord buildings and saying, what is this? You know, what is that on the wall? Why is that happening? And, of course, you had this crappy guy in charge who was looking terrified, right? Didn't know what the hell to do. And I had to keep doing that. And it was indeed like a sort of a process of illustration and existential demonstration of what works and what doesn't work, in the hopes that that would have an effect, that that would have some effect on people elsewhere. And so I think I got through the 6 years acting the way I'd always acted, but within the Constitution, and saying exactly what I wanted to say, but in a manner which was appropriate. Which is to say, not boring, but actually always, are you saying something which is in the line? I always said that Canadian democracy was built on public education. Having said that, I could actually attack publicly any attacks on public education without interfering in politics. In fact, what I was saying was the politicians who undermined freedom of speech or public education were acting against the public good. And I was speaking in favor of the public good, which would be my obligation. So it was all about the contextualization of the debate. Thank you.
Thank you.